I am Paul Harris. Thanks so much for listening here in the middle of the day in the middle of America. We all know parents who have fallen into the trap of becoming helicopter parents. They're the ones who are always overseeing everything their children do. I'm not just talking about, you know, you take your kid to soccer or Little League baseball, and those are the parents who are yelling at the umpire and yelling at the coach and making sure that their kid gets enough time on the field. Not just that, but elsewhere as well, including in their school life and in their social life. The parents are always scheduling them for everything. And again, I'm not talking about 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds. We're talking about kids who are getting up into middle school and high school and even college. Well, my next guest has written a book to kind of fight back against that. The book is called How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap, and Prepare Your Kid for Success. Her name is Julie Lithcott-Hames, and she joins me now here on the Big 550. Hi, Julie. How are you?
I'm well, Paul. Thanks so much for having me.
You spent a decade as the Dean of Freshman and Undergraduate Advising at Stanford University, which means you saw a lot of incoming teenagers who probably had come from homes exactly like the ones we're describing here today. Tell me about how that worked out for them.
Yeah, it's interesting you refer to them as incoming teenagers, because lately we've began calling college students kids. But back when you and I were 18 or 20, nobody called us
No,
kids.
We were adults, Julie, you and I.
We were adults, darn it.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was an administrator at Stanford and in conversation with administrators really all over the country in schools, public, private, every tier, in the middle of the last decade, we grew quite alarmed that parents were very involved in the day-to-day lives of their sons or daughters on our campuses, wanting to do everything from wake them up to keep track of their schedule, remind them of deadlines, deal with disputes if there was a concern over a grade or they weren't getting along with their roommate. Parents just felt they had a role to play. And, you know, I think that's because parents have been playing that role in the lives of their children, not just when they're young, as you mentioned at the top of the show, but in middle school, in high school. If they've been doing that all along, they really can't let go when their kid, quote unquote, though chronologically adult at 18, you know, still very much needs them in college.
You know, I can see that if you have kids who are staying at home and they're going to a local college, whether it's a community college or a university, but they're still living in the same house, obviously there's going to be that umbrella of family and concern. But once you send them off somewhere else, whether it's to Mizzou here in Missouri or to Stanford or to Duke in North Carolina, wherever it is, you have to like kind of clip that umbilical cord and say, you know what, see what it's like to be an independent person, don't you?
Absolutely. Paul, I'd even say if they're living under your roof, you still want to start treating them like an adult. You don't want them, you know, 18, 20, 22, acting like a child under your roof. Even if they're in college but living at home, they can behave like an adult. They can pitch in. They can help out. They can have responsibilities. They can be held accountable. They should also have more privacy, you know, but with that adult privacy and freedom also comes responsibilities. You know, yes, we have to clip the umbilical cord. As I like to say, we're mammals. Believe it or not, we're mammals. We may be mammals with clothing and a cell phone, but our job as mammals is to ensure that our offspring are raised to competent, confident adulthood so they can raise their own offspring one day. That's kind of how we got here. So, you know, childhood is supposed to prepare the way for that ultimate day of independence, not be a protective cocoon for 18 years.
You say in the book that the job of parents is to put themselves out of a job and raise kids to be independent. I think that's about as succinct as it can get.
Thanks.
I'd like you to share a couple of stories from the book, if you will, including the mother. This one made me laugh out loud. The mother who called the college admissions office and impersonated her daughter.
Well, I actually heard about this one on the radio myself. I think it was Ira Glass's show on NPR, who was talking with an admissions officer at Georgia Tech, who said, yeah, so parents are so involved, so concerned about college admission that they'll do much of the work of applying to college for their kid. And these days, that means parents are sort of acting like, you know, the administrative assistant, keeping track of the deadline and doing everything but writing the student's essay. And, of course, some parents even do that. But there's an element of college admission that includes letting the college know you're actually interested in that school, which you demonstrate by sending them emails or visiting the campus or, you know, giving them a call. So this mother was doing that on behalf of her kid, but trying to act as if she was the kid so that the kid would get points for having demonstrated an interest. And about 10 or 15 minutes into the call, she slipped up and stopped saying, you know, okay, if I'm interested in this, if I'm interested in that, she slipped up and said, now, if she's done more activities than you have room for,
uh-huh.
And all of a sudden she caught herself and realized she had blown her cover. you know, another example is, you know, because I think sometimes parents think, what's the harm? I'm overhelping, big deal. The problem is, if you teach your kid you'll always be there to make that phone call or argue with the referee or the coach, you know, or advocate on their behalf, then they'll always expect it. One of the stories in the book is about a young investment banker making $250,000 before the crash, whose mother was quite concerned that they were working her poor son too hard for $250,000. Shouldn't have mattered how hard he was working, I suppose. But
right.
She took it upon herself to call the boss to
find
his landline, track him down, call him on the weekend, and tell him, you're working my son too hard. Well, the boss barely made it through that phone call before completely losing it. He decided to fire the guy. The guy shows up for work on Monday, big skyscraper in New York, can't even get past security. He's handed a box of his belongings, and there's a note on top that says, ask your mother. You know, the point is, you know, we don't know. We want to prepare kids to fight and survive and thrive out there in the world. You know, we can't fight these kinds of battles for them. The better course would have been for that mother to talk to her son about, hey, you know, how can you, you know, look for different opportunities in that workplace? You know, maybe that boss is always going to work you that hard for that kind of money. Maybe you don't want to be doing this work anymore. But to take it upon herself to make that call just made her son look weak and incapable.
Absolutely. And not telling him that she made that call and this was the consequence that he finds out on Monday morning is absolutely classic.
Yeah.
Now, tell me, again, in your role of dean of freshmen at Stanford, how you would deal with some of these kids who had come out of these helicopter parent environments and were now faced with the independence that is living on a college campus, but they couldn't deal with it. What could you do to help them?
Well, one of the basic things I would do, because often, certainly at the beginning of the year, their mom or dad or both might have come to campus with them, and they'd want to all meet with me together, for example, to talk about some opportunities on the academic side of life, you know, a research opportunity. And so, you know, they'd all three want to meet with me, and I'd bring them into my office, but I'd make eye contact with the kid. And, you know, so then mom or dad would say, hi, we'd like to talk with you about opportunities for our son to do research on campus. And I'd smile and make eye contact briefly with the parents, but then I'd look directly at the kid and say, that's wonderful. I'd love to give you some ideas. Give me a sense of what you've already done in this arena, and then I can, you know, give you the best advice about how to plug in here at Stanford. And then the kid would sort of smile and nervously look left or right. There'd be a pause, and then mom or dad would explain to me, you know, what the kid had done, which was often very impressive to date. In other words, the kid was so accustomed to mom or dad doing the talking. He was used to showing up and being great at whatever they had set out for him by way of expectation, but he wasn't very good at narrating to his own experience. I would signal with my eye contact that you're an adult now, you're at college now, we're expecting to have these conversations with you, not your parents. And I was kind about it. But that was a subtle way of showing them, no, you can do this. You know, you're expected to be the one now to speak on behalf of your own self.
What do you think has been the effect of Adderall and other such attention deficit disorder drugs?
Well, certainly for kids with an ADD or ADHD diagnosis, they level the playing field and allow them to have a level of concentration and executive function skills they wouldn't otherwise have. The trouble is, what I'm hearing more and more is that these drugs are so prevalent, even kids without the diagnosis want to take them because it improves their concentration, or parents will do whatever they can to buy that diagnosis for their kid and get the kid the drugs, even if they know full well the kid doesn't actually have the problem. So it's become sort of like a steroid, sort of like a, you know, a doping situation where we're essentially, you know, we're becoming a society that says you're not good enough at, now I'm not talking about people with the actual diagnosis. I'm talking about the use of it by a much broader set in the population. We've basically said, you're not good enough the way you are. You need to be on drugs regularly in order to, you know, achieve more. And, you know, I know young people themselves who are saying, how long is this going to be true? Am I going to need to take these drugs for the rest of my life just to keep up in college or the workplace? I mean, yeah. And we don't know the long-term effect of many of these drugs.
I also wonder how much of that, for kids who aren't really diagnosed with that but are forced to take it by parents who, you know, they'd made the diagnosis and so they know that their kids need the drugs. How much of that comes from families who also structure every minute of the day for their child? You know, school's out. Okay, we're going to do this. Okay, we're going to do that. Okay, we're going to do another thing. Okay, and it's almost like a full spreadsheet's worth of activities in every day for every kid and no time to just sit back and be a kid.
Paul, you're really onto something there. You know, what you're describing is what I call in the book, How to Raise an Adult, the checklisted childhood. This is every moment is scheduled, structured, planned, hovered over, attended to by parents in furtherance of quote-unquote success. But research is increasingly showing that when kids don't have that all-important downtime to just be, as you so beautifully put it, it really undercuts their chances to develop a healthy psychological self. So we think we're helping them, but we're actually really, really harming them.
Yeah, it drives me crazy when I go out for a walk or a bike ride in the afternoon in the hours that would normally be considered after school time. I don't see any kids.
I know. And you're in Missouri and St. Louis. I'm in the Bay Area in California, and I hear this wherever I go with whomever I speak. Childhood has become this penned-in, fenced-in, safe, padded, structured place. And long gone are the days of kind of freedom and the wind blowing through your hair as you ride your bike to wherever. You know, look, I'm not trying to throw back to the 70s and somehow pretend that we can have that kind of childhood again magically in the United States. A lot has changed, but what hasn't changed is that free play is the work that children are supposed to do in order to learn how to design their way out of boredom, use their imaginations, resolve conflicts, figure stuff out. I mean, it's actually what they need to do. Just as important as homework in whatever class is that time with friends, that time with self, in order to construct that healthy adult human we all want them to be.
Last thing I want to ask you about, Julie, is you have two teenagers, right?
Right.
In writing this book, did you learn how you need to change?
Heck yeah. 2009, I was a dean who was wagging my finger at parents of freshmen saying, back off, go home, folks. I did that at a big dinner at the start of the school year. The next night I came home, realized I'm still cutting my own kids' meat. They're 8 and 10 at the time, and that was my aha moment. I am one of those parents. If I'm cutting their meat at 8 and 10, what makes me think I'm not going to feel the need to hover over their every experience, you know, through their teen years and into college? So, yeah, I cop to my own tendencies in the book. It's a very compassionate approach to the fears we have and our fierce love of our kids, and it just advocates, you know, hey, folks, if we want to them to be self-actualized adults who raise their own kids one day, we have to give them more independence, not foster dependence.
When the author admits that her book changed her, that's an idea of what it may have, the effect it may have on you. It's called How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. Julie Lithcott-Hames, a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Paul. Take care.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.